We hear a lot about the government wanting to minimise government debt, but you talk about that they're quite happy to tell students to take out an enormous HECS loan.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the public narrative in Australia is kind of so broken, it's hard to mock in one short podcast. But, you know,
we'll try our best.
One for mum, one for dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and in the June edition of the monthly, you'll find the latest essay by our Chief Economist Richard Dennis, called Grandfathering the Australian Dream. In it, he argues that Australia's young people have been unfairly targeted by policies that have loaded them up with uni debts, locked them out of the housing market, and crippled them on the flexible job front. And no, none of those reasons include a diet of smashed avocado on toast. In the essay, Richard explains that, quote, the easy way to introduce new policies is to phase them in slowly and to grandfather any changes so that they don't affect anyone who is presently in a position of power. And he writes that, quote, the cumulative impact of 20 years of such political pragmatism is that the neoliberal policies of spending cuts, fee increases and tax changes have been aimed almost exclusively at younger Australians, while older Australians have been grandfathered into relative safety. So joining me to discuss this essay is the author himself, Richard Dennis, and the Australia Institute's senior economist, Matt Grudnoff. The essay begins like this. The Liberal Party of Robert Menzies wanted all Australians to own their own home. The Liberal Party of Malcolm Turnbull wants us all to be landlords. The times, they are a-changing.
Well, the idea that everyone in Australia should own their own home is actually a pretty recent one. It really was post-World War II, Menzies' era, and Menzies was obviously a political conservative, and part of his conservatism suggested that if everyone had a stake in their community, if everyone put down roots in their community, that would make a nice, safe, happy community where people would, you know, work hard, pay their debts and vote Liberal.
That sounds very old-school conservative, doesn't it?
Indeed. And also, it sounds a bit odd to talk about this now, but at the time, that in the 60s in particular, where Menzies was implementing this kind of stuff, there were riots in countries like the US and the UK where inequality within cities was leading people to literally riot on the streets, burn houses down. So Menzies wasn't just trying to build his version of a nuclear family, white picket fence community. He was actually trying to protect Australia from radical forces, and he saw inequality as a major threat to what he saw as Australian value. But yeah, the modern Liberal Party seems to have an entirely different idea. If you're smart, you'd own six investment properties.
Yeah.
And it worked also because what we had was more stable suburbs. We had people going to schools, people putting down roots in particular suburbs, people having pride in where they lived because they were a part of it.
And the title of your essay is Grandfathering the Australian Dream. Where do we find ourselves now? How have things changed?
Well, we now live in an entirely different world where young people accumulate large debts when they're at university. They leave university often moving into casual work with no guarantee of income, no sick leave, no holiday leave. So very hard for them to make long-run plans, hard for them to borrow, hard for them to save up. And at the same time, they're competing in the housing market against people who get very generous tax concessions for their dream of buying multiple investment properties. So we talk about, well, if you're smart, you know, you should have investment properties, we should all be in on the game. That's the kind of Liberal solution. But let's be clear, if everyone owned an investment property as well as their own home, none of us would have any tenants.
Yeah, and that's an important point. Every time a property is sold to an investor, then that means that there must be another renter out there if they're going to fill that, which means our home ownership rates are going to fall. So the more investment properties that appear on the market, assuming that they can find tenants, then the more renters we're having in the market and the less owners, homeowners, we're actually having. And that's what we're seeing in the statistics. We're seeing that rental rates are rising, that people with mortgages, the amount of people with mortgages is also rising because as property prices go up, people have bigger mortgages for longer. And the group that's shrinking the fastest is people who own their own home outright. People who own a home without a mortgage are an increasingly scarce thing in Australia.
They're not getting enough financial advice. They're not minimising enough tax.
Exactly right. They haven't gone to the financial planner to tell them that they need to get out there and invest in residential property.
So, Matt, in the past, you've done a lot of research on exactly who benefits from negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount, and it benefits a small number of people the most. It's not something that extends to everybody.
That's right. So overwhelmingly, the majority of these two big tax concessions, negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount, flow to the wealthiest 20%. Something like about two-thirds of the benefits flow to the top 20%. And those benefits in total are about just over $10 billion a year. So the federal government is giving away $10 billion a year every year to make housing less affordable, to encourage people into the investment market to bid up house prices.
Housing affordability is in crisis. It's estimated that by next year, less than half of adults will own a home.
We don't want to be a nation in which the great Australian dream of home ownership is a memory.
It can only be described as a housing crisis.
House prices are soaring and wages have been flat for some time.
Richard's essay also examines the idea of good and bad debt. He writes, "There is a political logic to the strategy of loading up young people with a disproportionate share of budgetary pain. It comes with a disproportionately small amount of electoral pain. While squeaky wheels in the business community get the good oil of corporate tax cuts, young people get to rack up much larger HECS help debt, which is, of course, a good debt from the government's point of view."
The public narrative in Australia is kind of so broken, it's hard to mock in one short podcast. But, you know,
we'll try our best.
Yes, let me have a go. So for 20 years we've been told by neoliberal politicians and commentators that you need to run the country, you need to run the government the way you run a household.
Yeah.
That you can't live beyond your means, you can't rack up debt, you can't, you know, live off the future all the time.
Our national credit card is maxed out.
Australians live within their means, businesses live within their means, so must governments.
But they ultimately need to live within their means. That is their responsibility.
On the one hand, we say, you know, it's irresponsible for governments to borrow because households shouldn't borrow, households should only spend what they've got. But at the same time we're telling it, governments are saying to young people, you need to borrow $60,000 to go to university. But don't worry, we love debt so much that we, the government, will lend it to you. So young people today are leaving uni with a lot of debt compared to their income, and then they enter a rental market where rents have gone through the roof because years of all these tax concessions have done nothing to push rents down. They've gone up.
Yeah.
So they leave uni with high debt. They're entering a property market with high rents.
And a labour market that doesn't really deliver increases in wages. It's highly unstable compared to how it used to be.
That's right. Very flat wages growth. But again, for young people, far more than old people, probably a far less stable, predictable stream of income. You know, far more young people are working in the gig economy. Far more young people are working as casuals. So it's much harder for them to talk a bank into lending them money. They still have to go off at an auction and bid for a house against people that never had a HECS debt, who accumulated capital under the old rules, but get to bid against them at an auction under the new rules. And then we get surprised to see that home ownership amongst young people is not just collapsing, but is just considered by a large number of them to be effectively out of their reach. They're not even trying anymore. And then, of course, we blame them for abandoning a game they can't win.
When they're not too busy smashing avocados, millennials seem to spend considerable energy accusing us baby boomers of hoovering up all the affordable housing. That's really not fair.
When I was trying to buy my first home, I wasn't buying. Smashed avocados for $19 and four coffees at $4
each. So you reckon that's real?
Oh, there's no question it's real.
I feel sorry for Generation X. They are right slap bang in the middle of the toughest part of life in many respects.
In the essay, Richard argues that these labels, such as Gen X, Gen Y and Millennial, are used to help disguise structural problems as behavioural traits, which stops us from asking the simple questions like, why doesn't Australia have a wealth tax? How will cutting the company tax rate help young people or old people in need? And how on earth can someone who earns $1 million per year pay not a cent in tax?
A lot is made in Australia of the generational wars. You know, there's the retirees and the baby boomers and the Gen X and the Gen Y and the millennials. And what it actually does is conceal what a whole bunch of Australians born in different years have in common. There are lots of people in their 60s and 70s who don't own their own home. They are priced out of the housing market. Rents are high for them too. If we didn't focus as much on age, if we actually just focused on need and fair and good, and then young people who can't afford a home, middle-aged people who can't afford a home, and older people who can't afford a home might actually work together and be an incredibly powerful political force that saw that the small handful of people that Matt described getting billions a year in tax concessions, that if older people and younger people could unite in demanding that those things get changed, in a democracy they'd probably win. And that's why I think people work so hard to categorise people into these small groups, because they're actually afraid that middle-income earners and low-income earners of all ages might unite to say 20 years of tax concessions for housing have made houses dearer, not cheaper. Can we follow every other country's lead and do it differently, please?
And also not just dividing them into groups, but pitting them against them. So, you know, smashed avocado is why you can't afford to buy a house. I mean, it's so ridiculous, it's silly, but the purpose behind it is to point out that those young people, they're lazy, they're wasting their money on unessential things, whereas when you were a kid or young, you saved hard and worked hard and that's why you got your home.
Yeah, you can understand why a bunch of older people that have never ordered smashed avocado for breakfast in their life think, oh yeah, I never wasted money on stuff like that. But that's trivial when it comes to understanding the barriers that young people face. And, you know, let's face it, Europe does exist, and there are people that can afford a home in Germany and buy avocados as well.
The starting point for a first home buyer is to get a good job that pays good money.
You need to have two jobs, and often you need one of those jobs to be quite flexible.
There are jobs out there. What we need is motivated and active job seekers.
Richard points out that today there are more than 730,000 unemployed people in Australia, and the youth unemployment rate is above 15%. He writes that older voters remember that Australians once did a good day's work for a good day's pay. Younger Australians know that to get a job, you often need to work as an unpaid intern. Or some do unpaid training shifts. And despite the fact that politicians can get paid more for one night's travel allowance than the unemployed get in total for a whole week, the unemployed benefit didn't rise in the latest budget. Instead, the poorest people in Australia, a disproportionate number of whom are young, got another dose of lecturing. Accompanied by a headline in the Adelaide Advertiser, Federal Budget 2017, lazy welfare bludges to lose payments under demerit system. So on this idea of being lazy, Richard talks about being unemployed, fresh out of uni, but why he was never called lazy.
When I finished uni, it was the recession of the early 90s.
And the one we had to have.
The one we had to have. The one that everyone knew was caused by government policy. Yeah, while unemployment was a dreadful experience, I was lucky enough to be unemployed at a time when no one suggested it was because I was lazy. Everyone understood that when, you know, 1.5 million people were looking for 400,000 jobs, a lot of people were going to miss out, and I was one of them for nearly 2 years.
Through no fault of their own, and even though you had an economics degree.
That's right.
perhaps because of
that. Yeah, so our culture has changed quite dramatically, and of course the 2014 budget is full of egregious examples of that. But in the 2014 budget, the then Treasurer Hockey simultaneously announced a $10,000 bonus for any employer who would employ someone who was over 55. An unemployed person over 55, if offered a new job, came with a $10,000 check attached to them. And in the same budget, he tried to make young unemployed people wait 3 months before they were eligible for any support. So, you know, I don't think you could get a clearer example of how generational our politics are. Older unemployed people are apparently the most disadvantaged group in the country. Uh-huh. So disadvantaged that they need a $10,000 check pinned to them.
Yeah.
Whereas younger Australians, Aboriginal people in regional areas, single mums, they don't suffer any disadvantage in the labour market at all. They've got the life of Riley, and it's so easy for them that we should make it harder for them to get the dole in the same budget.
Yeah. And magically, somehow, young people can go 3 to 6 months with no income to help pay their rent or buy their groceries, or like that was just a shocking policy.
It was, and again, it really sort of reflects a bizarre lack of intergenerational understanding. The implication was, well, your parents should look after you. Well, a lot of the most vulnerable young people who can't find work might live in families and in regions where their parents suffer similarly.
Mm.
So to suggest that you can all just, you know, go and sleep in the spare room at mum and dad's, or maybe hang out in their holiday house for a while until things pick up.
You probably find, though, that a lot of politicians came from families that could support them in that way.
Well, that's right. And so, again, these cliches about, you know, young people might be poor, but, you know, their parents can look after them. Well, not everyone middle-aged can afford to look after their kids. There's poverty across every age group in Australia.
And it's also important to note that all around the world and in Australia, we actually measure youth unemployment separately to the total unemployment. And the reason we do that is because youth unemployment in Australia and all over the world is higher than the average unemployment rate. Mm-hmm. That is, we recognise, the statistics show that young people are more likely to be unemployed, not because they're all lazy, because this has happened over a long period of time across all over the world, because they're just disadvantaged in the labour market. They don't have the skills yet and the experience to land good jobs. So to then punish them further, to pick on that group and say, well, you need to try harder, is just silly.
So what you're saying is Joe Hockey's advice at the time to young people struggling to get into the housing market of just get a better paying job doesn't really cut it in policy terms.
Look, it's ridiculous. Like the idea that we can all be landlords, the idea that we could all afford a home if we all got a better job makes absolutely no sense in economics whatsoever. If everyone got a $50,000 pay rise, then all that would happen is the price of houses would go up.
Yeah. So how do they get away with it?
Well, sadly, their political calculus is a lot better than their policy analysis. Young people are less likely to vote. Young people are less likely to change their vote. And young people are less likely to make a lot of noise when they are the victims of bad policy. Rich superannuants scream and whinge and complain when modest changes to their way above average wealth are proposed. All I can say to young people who think they're being ripped off is, you're right, but no one's going to do anything about that unless you're willing to make some noise and shift some votes.
The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
The squeaky wheel gets the grease and the tax concessions.
And before we go, we'll share this commentary by our friends at SBS TV's The Feed, who summed up the housing market nicely.
Karen and Stuart have always dreamed of owning their own home in the city.
But there's all chance of that happening, so they've bought this avocado instead. They've got some big plans for it.
For this design, I've gone for a smashed avocado. It's a metaphor for their smashed hopes of ever owning a home.
That's been episode 20 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. You can find more episodes on our website, tai.org.au/podcasts, or wherever you download your favourite podcasts. And if you liked it, please give us a rating. It helps other people to find us. You can find Richard's essay at themonthly.com.au and more of Matt Grudnoff's work on our website. You can follow Matt at MATTGRUDNOFF or Richard is at RDNS_TAI. And the Twitter handle for the Australia Institute is the Oz Institute with an AUS. And I'm on Twitter at Ebony_Bennett with a NNTT. Don't forget, you can still get tickets to join us on August 17th for the Accountability and the Law Conference, where Nicholas Cowdery and Geoffrey Watson will be leading the discussion on whether Australia needs a federal anti-corruption commission. Just go to our website to book tickets and for more information. We really hope to see some of our listeners there. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track, additional music composed by Paul Macy. Thanks for listening.